Welcome to Come Inside.
Today's guest is Dr. John Fabian. John is a forensic and clinical psychologist, as well as being a forensic and clinical neuropsychologist. He has a national practice in the US, specializing in criminal and civil forensic psychological and neuropsychological evaluations. He was formerly the director of a state court psychiatric clinic. He has worked in adult and juvenile court psychiatric clinics, a state forensic hospital, and a Federal Bureau of Prison Forensic Center. He has examined well over 4,000 criminal forensic cases, and it's estimated that anywhere between 600 to 700 of those cases were murder cases. He has worked in around 25 states in the US. He is recognized as an expert when it comes to forensically assessing a violent or sexually violent offender. He also teaches courses in forensic psychology, neuropsychology, and the law, as well as teaching college graduate and medical students how to do a violence risk assessment. He is published in Law Review, Peer Review, and Bar journals. So he really is an expert when it comes to talking about the brain. I really enjoyed this conversation. I actually learned a lot. It was really interesting. I had a great time doing it. And speaking to him, he was really lovely. I think you'll enjoy it too. So enjoy.
So you're a forensic and clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist, right?
Yes, that's what I do. So I basically, you know, have a doctorate in clinical and forensic psychology. And, you know, that's basically the study assessment of human behavior, but more when we apply it to legal questions. So the forensic arena really means you're an expert on something. So, you know, in the US we have forensic files. So they on TV where you may say, you know, see blood splatter expert, you may have fingerprint DNA. So I assess essentially defendants for trial and sentencing. And right. And that would be an expert witness. And so these clinical psychology is really performing psychological testing for mental disorders such as schizophrenia, depression, PTSD, and then also assessing and diagnosing these disorders and then applying that to a legal question such as competency to stand trial, not guilty by reason of insanity, mitigating factors at sentencing, for example.
Okay. And are you hired by the defense or do you ever come in and work for the prosecution?
Well, so in criminal cases, and I originally was from the state of Ohio, and they have a number of what we call court psychiatric clinics. And so they are scattered in the states within larger cities, there'll be one court clinic or if they're in regions where maybe a court clinic will cover several counties or rural areas. Okay. And so there's people that are either consultants or full-time paid by the state who do these evaluations for the courts. And so they are the court expert. Okay. Now in Texas, where I live now, and Florida, the experts are on a panel. They'll just be on their own shingle. And the court, the defense, and occasionally the prosecutor will want their own opinion. And so you kind of do it in a private practice model. And then I also worked in Minnesota where they had one court psychiatric clinic for the Twin Cities, a large area of Minneapolis. And then I worked at like the maximum security state hospital for the state. And so a lot of the defendants would come to the facility, okay, for evaluation. Okay. Those are like the three models that we use in the US.
Okay. Is there one model that you think works better than the others or do they all kind of have their place?
That's a good question. And then, you know, how you get reimbursed and paid. So it gets a little technical, but, you know, I would say the states are going away from having them come to the facility because a lot of the guys or women do not need to be there for a long time and their bed space costs more for the state.
Yes.
So I would say the model is often the consultant, who gets paid by the state that will go to the jail to see the person, or they'll be on bond and they will, you know, free in the community to travel to the doctor at that office. So, you know, that's kind of the where the trend has been more in the last, I'd say, 10 or 15 years.
Okay. And what are the things that you are looking for in order to deem someone competent to stand trial?
Okay. So, and I will say, as a forensic psychologist, again, we're looking at human behavior, we're looking at psychiatric diagnoses, and we're applying those to legal questions, those symptoms or conditions. As a neuropsychologist, I am doing that, but I had to get other training into neurological disorders such as dementia, Alzheimer's, seizures, traumatic brain injury, okay, alcohol dementia, let's say, which go beyond the mental illness, the traditional mental illness. So, and then we will do neuropsychological testing to assess like brain function in areas of, let's say, attention, memory, executive functioning, problem solving, reasoning. So typically, I kind of act as a hybrid where I do the psychology and the neuropsychology, which is real helpful to how I conceptualize a case. But typically, you know, the defense lawyer is representing a defendant and they'll have concerns based on their interaction with their client. So competency to stand trial in the US and internationally is typically, you know, do they have a mental illness? And do they understand how the court system works, their legal situation, and can they assist with their defense? So can they testify in court? Can they make legal decisions? It often is started by the defense lawyer who's representing the defendant, and then they'll request the court to have their client evaluated.
So how do you decide whether or not a juvenile should be tried as an adult? And I mean, do you think that that's fair for a juvenile to be tried as an adult? Does it depend on the crime?
Is it? Yeah, that is a really good question. And it's something kind of near and dear to what I do or believe in. So the U.S. Supreme Court in a case, Kent, I think it was United States of America, I think, versus Kent. Kent was a juvenile. And it was, I believe, in the 1960s where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that, you know, in some ways juveniles are different than adults, and that in order to, transfer the child to adult court for them to be tried as an adult. And in the U.S., we call it one of three things: juvenile transfer, juvenile waiver, or juvenile bind over. And basically, they said, hey, we need to look at three things. One, the sophistication and maturity of the individual. Two, treatment amenability. Are they amenable to treatment? And three, safety of the community based on, you know, in much part what their offense was and what their juvenile record was. So, you know, when I look at this, in the 1990s, the laws got very harsh on juvenile offenders, and basically, they were presenting an automatic waiver or transfer based on the crime. So there were either a gang specification, gun specification, where there was no discretion. So we kind of look at this as a discretionary transfer or a mandatory transfer or an automatic prosecutor file. Bottom line is, the mandatory means a judge cannot even look at the case and they're already automatically transferred to adult court. And that may be on age, but certainly the severity of the crime. And then the discretionary means, hey, let's look at this kid from a holistic point of view, everything about his background, and then look at those three things of risk, you know, sophistication, maturity, and treatment amenability.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Do you think that it's a better option to look at the whole picture rather than just the crime? I mean, some people would say no, but.
Well, you know, absolutely. And I, that is where it's kind of near and dear where, you know, this is kind of all I do. And I'm pretty blessed to have this, you know, I love what I do and I do it around the United States, not just in one area. And I do a lot of, let's say, death penalty work with adults, but a lot of those offenders were juvenile delinquents, and a lot of those kids were not raised right. All right. And they were, as I say, raised by wolves. And then in juvenile court, similarly raised by wolves. And so before we start transferring and treating a kid like as an adult, I feel and think that we should, you know, really look at them holistically, because for two reasons. One, you know, how does someone get to the way they get? Why do they commit the crime? Okay. Yeah. And B, the research on those who are transferred to adult court is not good, meaning kids that are transferred to adult court and become adults and are eventually released usually reoffend. Okay. So their recidivism rates are not good. They're tossed typically in a state prison. Let's say you're transferred at age 16, your case, you finally get convicted in adult court at 17 and you're sentenced, you go to like a holding pot in a prison with like 17, 18, 19 year olds. And then you transition to adult prison in that same facility. And, you know, there's a lot of theory, but it's like, you know, birds of a feather flock together. You kind of learn the way, you get institutionalized, and now you're an adult, you get out, and the recidivism rates are quite high. So before you just transfer them and have that as a consequence, you should really look to see, do we do everything we could for this kid before we transferred him?
So when we look at brain development, I've always been confused as to how we could try a juvenile as an adult.
Right. And, you know, it depends on the study. Okay. And, you know, there's a lot of research on this and we could, you know, talk for 3 days on it, but and in the United States Supreme Court has held recently, you cannot execute a juvenile and you cannot sentence a juvenile to life without parole without a fair hearing. So you can't execute a juvenile no matter what, but you cannot really sentence a child to life without parole without a fair hearing. So I'm getting cases where now the defendant is 40, got, you know, tried as an adult or, you know, and sentenced to life without parole when he was 16, and now we got to reevaluate the case. Okay?
Yeah, okay.
So there's a sentencing hearing and now he has 40. His brain is developed. Right. And we have to kind of go back in time retrospectively. So that gets into a very unique legal process, but to answer your question more clinically in a neuroscience perspective, you know, the research will kind of, you know, emphasize that the brain, especially the frontal lobe. So our brains, you know, start developing more prehistorically, so to speak, in the back, more in the brain stem, survival functions, heart rate, you know, to the frontal lobe, which is more of like probably age 23. So, you know, crack my skull open, your frontal lobes here, you know. Yeah. Those are really responsible for, as you may know, for executive functioning, problem solving, planning, deliberating, impulse control, decision making. Okay. So there has been a lot more research by social psychologists and neuroscientists where they have developed research protocols on decision making, judgment, and found juveniles to be more impulsive than adults. And have also, you know, kind of relayed, hey, why do we have rules of, you know, getting into the military, driving, you know, laws, drinking, right? Yeah. But we can yet transfer someone to adult prison. So there's been more political considerations, norms, kind of cultural questions, and research. And they've also, you know, tested with MRI imaging, brain imaging, especially as to how the brain, we call myelinates, and how our shrubs of our brain are kind of pruned and where more of what we call white matter is developing. And that really is key to how we really process information. That really doesn't get developed until teens and even early 20s. So with all of that neuroscience literature, then there is really, you know, a lot of pleadings in court, eventually to the U.S. Supreme Court, as to, hey, we really need to look at this data culturally and scientifically.
Okay, so if we go back to that case you were just talking about, 16 years old, sentenced to life without parole, is now 40. And although their brain would be developed, do you think it will be somewhat, for lack of a better term, stunted in a way because they've been sitting in a prison for 24 years?
Well, so I do want to highlight this. This is real important. When I see these defendants, whether they're juveniles or adults, they often have developing, you know, they'll have a developing brain if they're 17, but often it's a damaged developing brain, which I kind of call it like a double whammy where you, if you have a lot of trauma, childhood trauma, you weren't raised right. We kind of call it attachment deficits, nurturing, lack thereof, abuse. The literature has also looked at just abuse, trauma, and brain development, post-traumatic stress, sort of PTSD, where as a child, your what we call the limbic system, like really deep in the core, and you know, the amygdala, is going to be where we have the kind of engine in the brain, the fight, flight, the impulsive emotional brain. Okay. Where it's basically your alarm or watchdog for threat, fear. And kids more likely respond to that without their frontal lobes developed, where they deliberate. Wait, before I do this, think about consequences. Problem is, many of the juvenile delinquents, they are compromised in early brain development with a number of risk factors. So mom uses substances during pregnancy, dad beats mom and she falls when she's pregnant. She smokes during pregnancy. She's on methamphetamine, that kind of thing. And then when the child's born, there is just neglect, lack of connection, nurturance, poor attachment. And then this child's exposed to trauma. So immediately this amygdala that is kind of like your emotional part of your brain is on high alarm. And so they are more likely to develop other neurodevelopmental conditions. So ADHD, attention deficit, hyperactivity, learning disability. Yeah. And those disorders are both more prevalent with juveniles. So you're starting to see a conglomeration of risk factors, not only like prenatally, but once the child's born, they're more likely to have ADHD, they're more likely to have abuse, they're more likely to have learning disabilities, and their brain is still developing. So all of that together, and then you throw in, okay, they're in a very poor area of a city, okay, like big cities, Melbourne, Sydney, New York, whatever, you're exposed to other youth in the same situation with broken homes, poverty, yeah, early substance use. How does that early, you know, these drugs now, not marijuana only, but K2, methamphetamine, spice, how does that affect this brain that's already compromised, but yet still developing?
Yeah.
So that's where we get into more problems. These are just really high risk youth from what we call like a biopsychosocial perspective, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And a lot of times, you know, you have to, as an expert, educate the judges or juries as to really what you're dealing with, because the prosecutor will say he made choices.
Yeah. And I've got an issue with that because of pretty much everything you just outlined and some things I didn't even know in what you just outlined. They are so impulsive. But I wonder, so what, you'll be able to explain this probably better than anyone, but what happens to your brain development when you are being abused and that as a child? What does it stunt? Do we know? There's probably a lot of research that says a few different things.
You're right. I mean, and I would kind of focus a little bit on, you know, or more on what we call that limbic system, that emotional brain.
Yeah.
Because the emotional brain is, you know, when you have a baby crying, it's like this big and your frontal lobes in the baby are like this big. Okay. Yeah. So that's why there's, you know, all the chaos, right? Well, when you're being abused and or neglected, that limbic system is just, it's really, what's the best word? Like, real, it's going to be really inconsistent with its development because the child's life and surroundings are typically chaotic and inconsistent. Okay, so areas of that limbic system, I think the right part of our brain is more of our emotional brain, is going to be more compromised.
Okay.
And so it different, even, you know, neurocircuitry and connections are going to be compromised in their development, where it'll be just, you know, kind of a more a compromised system. And there are certain studies where that amygdala is not as, it is shrunk. It is not as developed, for example, in those who are abused.
What's the most critical part of brain development, like age-wise? It's hard. I've read a whole bunch of different things. Some say from the moment you're born till you're three. Some say a bit later on.
Each time is quite significant, you know, as far as like your, you know, survival brain versus the emotional development brain versus the deliberating brain. Like, we can even see that in middle, like mid-elementary school years to fifth, sixth, seventh grade. The classwork material is less concrete. It's more abstract. Okay. So that's where you're starting to really develop reasoning. And then not long after that, these, you know, frontal lobes are really kind of more developing. But I would not really isolate periods of time. They're all, you know, important, certainly to me. But what I really would highlight is that a lot of these kids have developing kind of what we call dysfunctional brains. They're not functioning correctly because of these risk factors.
Okay. And so where do you sit on the debate about nature versus nurture? Do you think one is more important than the other? Do you think it is a mix?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that it's a mix. And, you know, there's intelligence, I think, if I'm correct, is somewhere, you know, with mother and father, somewhere 25%+ is genetic. So it has to be, you know, based in part personality and IQ, intelligence, as to be somewhat significantly genetic based. But then, you know, nurturing is huge based on just parental education, having two parents together, and for there to be a more solid, consistent upbringing versus the chaotic, you know, neglect, abuse upbringing.
Yeah, okay. And a genetic predisposition to criminal behavior, do you believe in that theory?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and absolutely. Yeah? There's been some genetic studies, I think, more in even in the 90s, I think in the Netherlands, let's say, just more on twin studies and where twins raised together separately, there's certainly a significant relationship between both. I mean, the nature and the nurture. So there's never going to be a divorce with that. I mean, they're always going to be, you know, I don't know if we'll ever be able to decide what's more important. I think that when we get into criminal court and we're explaining this information to the trier of fact, nurture is more profound than nature. Yeah. When people weighing decisions on what to do, how to sentence this person, how to treat them, rehabilitate them, it's going to be nature is more considered.
Okay. And so maybe you'd be able to explain what happens to someone's brain when they have PTSD.
Similar. I mean, that emotional part of the brain, especially the amygdala. And they've had some studies even with these veterans, these soldiers coming back from Afghanistan, let's say their amygdala is smaller, not always, but there's studies suggesting that, where that trauma area of your brain has less volume to it.
Okay.
It's correlative. It's not always going to be causative, but because not everyone that comes back or has been raped or sexually abused as a child is going to have a smaller amygdala. Okay. Yeah. But there are, you know, studies certainly. And I also will emphasize, you know, unless like in the United States, unless this is like a major death penalty case, a lot of times they're not going to fund and pay for brain imaging in a case. Sometimes they do. You know, so not everyone has this whole toolkit of assessments that we can do.
Okay. And is there a way to repair the amygdala? Or is it once it kind of shrinks, are you just, you just have to learn how to deal with that?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, there is possibilities with, well, first of all, I mean, we want to get this person, you know, in a more stable environment. Okay. Number one. Now, whether they can have therapies and different psychiatric medications, you know, it's possible. I would say, you know, there's still research being done on that. Number one thing is to get them in more of a stable environment. I would also say that I have a very interesting case going on right now that is, it's a little bit different, but it's with a case of encephalitis where it was a bacterial infection of the brain of a normal functioning 18-year-old who now is 20, but he has dementia of the brain from this encephalitis. Wow. And it has taken the volume down of his hippocampus, his amygdala, leaving him having dementia with really no memory of problems learning and recalling, but also he's very more impulsive. So they are doing infusion therapy with him, which your volumes of your brain can bounce back.
Okay.
Okay, so it really kind of a different type where it wasn't trauma or abuse, but still volumes have shrunk in his brain. But I also think that, like, certainly trauma-based therapy could improve, you know, one's condition. Now, as far as it improving the function volume of the amygdala, probably the function, I'm not clear on the volumetric studies on that.
Okay. And so how do you come to the conclusion on whether or not someone is not guilty by reason of insanity? Is there a checklist that you go through? What, you know?
Right. So it depends on the state. There's essentially three laws in the United States. One is, do you have a severe mental disease and or defect? And did you know the wrongfulness of your acts? Did you know right from wrong? The second one is similar, and the U.S. government has this in federal cases. Did you have a severe mental disease or defect, and did you understand the nature and quality or wrongfulness of your offenses? Okay. So nature, quality, or wrongfulness. And the third one, which I like, is did you have a severe mental disease or defect? And did that impair your ability to understand or appreciate the criminality of your offenses or conform your behavior to the requirements of the law? That third gets more into impulse control or inability to conform or control your acts.
Okay.
It's a little bit more inclusive of human behavior. A lot of the first two, a lot of it is based on cognition. Did you know right from wrong? Versus were you able to control your behavior?
Is it hard to determine if someone knew right from wrong?
Very much so. Because
I'm trying to figure out
that. No, another topic we could be here for days, but basically a individual often will come to my office or I'll go to the jail a year after the murder. Okay. And this person may be on medication. They may have come to terms with what they did. They may have tried to make meaning for what they did. And then it's a retrospective mental state evaluation. Hey, when you did this a year ago and killed your father, what were you thinking? Well, we really want to look at police reports, what they said they did at the time, like as close in time before, during, and after that offense. So we can look to say, what was the last psychiatric record before the offense? What did they say to the police? Did they flee from the crime scene? Was their behavior rational? And that's really what we look at. And was their behavior rational or was it irrational, the motive of their behavior? So it's very difficult when a defendant will tell me what they did. And I'll say, well, did you know right from wrong? Well, I wasn't thinking of that when I did it. Yeah. I know it's wrong now, a year later. And that's where it becomes really difficult to try to get in their mind in a retrospective mental state.
Do you think it would be a better idea that you evaluate them earlier? Like, shouldn't that be the process that's put in, that you're doing it pretty much as soon as it's happened, as soon as they've been caught?
Yes. I had a case last year where the woman killed her two children and buried them in her yard. And I saw her within days of her doing that. So you're seeing the person in a more raw mental state.
Yeah.
And more, I think their rendition, just intuitively, I think their recall and what happened is more accurate 2 days after it than a year later.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you would think that. I want to talk a little bit about children. Well, not just children, but we'll go with children making false accusations of being sexually abused. How do you determine whether or not they're telling the truth or if it's maybe a version of the truth? And, you know, their memory can be a little sketchy because they're children and it's traumatic. Yeah. And you hear about this quite a bit.
Right. You are asking very good questions. So, they're not easy, but they're at,
no, they're not.
No. So I will say this one thing: the research will say that, to be honest, only about, I'd say, 8, give or take, percent of all accusations of child sex abuse are false. So. Okay. We need to know that it's not like 90% are false or 50-50. No. Most claims of child sex abuse are true. Okay.
Okay.
Now, courts often do not allow that evidence in. Okay. They don't often do not allow percentage evidence in. All right. Okay. For different reasons. But the other thing would be for us to also know interview protocol and procedure, professional guidelines. So there are different programs, I'm sure even Australia, where, you know, there's a right way and a wrong way, but different methodologies that are accepted within the field of law enforcement, psychology, sexual abuse investigation. You know, and the rule of thumb is ask questions that are open-ended that are not leading. So what happened, rather than a more specific question? So knowing kind of the literature and the accepted protocols of child sex abuse interrogation, investigation, questioning. 3, we would want to know what the research says on traits of or commonalities in cases that are false allegations or risk factors. Yep. So we know, like, mother's mental illness, recent divorce, separation, child's mental illness, child's low functioning. And I had a case recently that I consulted on where I watched the alleged victim, her interview, and I knew that I had her mental health records, and I knew she had an IQ of about low 50s. Okay. So she was mentally retarded, intellectually disabled, and she was a vulnerable alleged victim, but vulnerable also to leading questions. And so I could tell the interviewer was wanting to get at something and was frustrated when the child was not indicating or providing that information, and was also often leaving the room, the interviewer, to get advice by a colleague, coming back and not getting the information she wanted, and then was developing the interview into a more closed-ended and leading interview. Okay. And it, to the point where I got involved and I said, this is a problem. I mean, the girl is giving inconsistent statements and does not understand the questions because she has a 50 IQ. So if you're not getting what you want, I mean, the examiner will just basically tell you what tell the child what they want to hear. Okay.
What they want. Yeah.
So, and by the way, they dismissed those charges. Okay. Because of that, it wasn't done right. It was a difficult case. I could tell the interviewer has, you know, was frustrated. It was like, you know, what do we do? This girl's not understanding, you know, it's a tough case, but there may be inherent biases by the interviewer, you know, that's another issue. Now, as far as memory and what we call confabulation, certainly younger children, I would say, are more at risk for creating false memories or truthfully lying, saying things that they believe that were true that were not. And they're going to be more susceptible to, you know, these other peripheral issues of like mother or, you know, other folks involved in the case. Okay. So knowing childhood memory formation and maturity and brain development certainly is relevant in those forensic cases as well.
Okay. And when we maybe look at someone who is sexually abusing children, do we know what's going on in their brain for them to be aroused by a child, which just seems crazy? But yeah, like, do we know enough about what is actually going on in their brain that makes them think it's okay? Or do you think maybe they know it's not okay, but they're doing it anyway because they're aroused by that? Or I'm sure it's more complicated than that.
Well, it depends on the age, maturity, a lot of other factors. But I will say, you know, I mean, it may be as simple in part as monkey see, monkey do. Okay. So if a child is abused, fondled, they may be more likely to act out that way. I will say that when we look at all of these articles and the research on children and are there clear risk factors for child sex abuse, let's say, as much as I want to say yes, and these are the signs, so an expert can testify just by education to the research and just say, hey, jury, judge, children who are sexually abused often have these signs. They may act sexually out. They may struggle with their grades. They may have depression. You will find research articles that say a child can be sexually abused with no risk factors. They have nothing wrong with them. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and that kind of flies in the face of what we think may be true, but it's kind of hard. There's no formula. There's no, okay, this is exactly these risk factors have to be present. But as far as their brain is concerned, certainly it could be traumatic. And it's also our brains are affected in different areas as to how we form traumatic-based memories. This is a very complicated field. And some of it overlaps with what we were talking about before as far as abuse and then offending.
Okay. Have you had to evaluate any violent sexual predators before who you thought were no longer a risk to society?
Yes. So 20 of the 50 states have a what they call a sexual violent predator civil commitment law, where they, if the offender has a history of sex offenses, usually more than, you know, two or more, they have a similar like a mental disease or abnormality that has linked them to commit offenses such as pedophilic disorder, pedophilia. And then they are deemed by an expert to be more likely than not to reoffend, which gets into certainly battle of experts of diagnosis and risk of reoffending. Then they can be committed indefinitely into like a state hospital for sex offenders. So I have, you know, I do these regularly. I had a case, this is interesting, a case the other day where the state of New York beat me to the punch. The defense asked me to evaluate an 82-year-old who I've evaluated before and recommended release. Okay. Now in New York, it's special. They have a special intensive parole, super parole. So even if you're in the state hospital, you're released, you're not free. Like you have parole. Okay. Yeah. I had recommended this guy's release because I knew there's a risk management. I knew there's a system to watch and supervise him. Many states, if you get released, there's no paper, there's no supervision. You're just out on your own.
You're out. Yeah.
Now this guy was 82 and he had about 7 child victims over, and his last sex offense against a child was age 69.
Oh, wow.
Which is old. Okay.
Yeah.
His first one was at, 26. So we have a 40-year history.
Wow. Crime,
okay. Yeah. I said, hey, he's ready to be released. The state said no. But once he just recently developed stage 3 or 4 cancer, they don't want to pay for it.
Ah, so then they release him. Okay.
Right. So
that's interesting. Like, so they knocked back what you said because they obviously thought he was still a risk, but then he develops stage 3 cancer and then it's like, all right, he's not a risk anymore. See you later.
In part because now he has more medical ailments. I think it's, there's smoke and mirrors there, but whatever. Right. So
that's interesting.
And by the way, these men all want to get out, most of them. Okay. Some of them are institutionalized, but this particular man who wanted to get out, now he has cancer. He wants to stay because he wants the treatment and the medical care. Right. So anyway, that's kind of an interesting side note.
That is interesting. Do you have a theory as to why people commit certain crimes? So talking about really heinous crimes, murder, rape, cannibalism, things along that type of line.
Well, I mean, you know, every case is different. I mean, I call it like pretty heavy lifting. So what I do a lot of murder cases and a lot of like sexually violent cases. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I have, you know, as you would expect, some murder cases where, you know, the person selling crack cocaine and someone infringes on their territory and they shoot them. Okay. Right. So, or they rob a bank and someone gets shot. So there's motivations of monetary gain, whatever. There are a lot of cases where there's more of a mental health, a brain, a neurological condition, sex offenders, why do they rape? What part of the brain is causing someone to molest children? I'll give you an example where we had a gentleman who had a severe brain injury, and we had imaging, and the imaging was in the lesions were in the, let's say, the frontal temporal area of the brain. And then that really kind of clicked in pedophilia, where he was really obsessed with child pornography and was hanging out at an 8-year-old's house down the street with a teddy bear panda stuffed with marijuana in it and wanted to pursue this girl. Okay. And so like more of a child interest impulse control pedophilia, you know, that was more based on brain damage. But why do the other typical pedophiles, we don't have known brain damage, do this? And so there is more research recently, especially out of Canada, that's coming out, that's talking about some brain anomalies that may be related more to, you know, pedophilic tendencies. Or similarly, there's a newer study out on MRIs of the brain of parolees who violated parole. And they found a statistical significance in the MRI of an area called the anterior cingulate cortex and the prefrontal cortex that has to do in part with disinhibition. Okay. So does that mean every parolee needs an MRI before they're released? You know, so in 2020, I don't know, but I will say early childhood trauma is huge.
Yeah. Okay. And is that something that you've noticed is a similarity in a lot of the cases you've evaluated?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I cannot say it's causative because not every kid has it, but there is a correlative marker there.
Okay. And
yeah, there is. It's just, but again, a lot of this goes together. Poverty, broken homes, neglect, you know. So we're never going to have, I always kind of joke when I'm with a defendant, like I'll have this laptop and I'll say, you know, my fingerprint will get into my laptop as my code. So like, we're not going to have like that where we'll do that. And it's like, okay, 18% of this murder was your mother's prenatal methamphetamine use. 22% was your learning disability. You know, we'll never do that. Okay.
No, you just put it all together.
You do. You do what you can. And there are some people who, you know, are they mad or they're bad? Right. But I will say a lot of the research, even if you have, let's say, a personality disorder and the person's a psychopath, let's say, their findings of brain abnormalities too.
You know, okay.
Of kind of like a conscience or lack thereof.
Yeah, okay. Because there are a lot of people in the world who have been abused and gone through trauma and had horrible upbringings and all the rest of it who don't go on to commit these type of crimes. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's an argument that people will use to be like, well, why should we give these people almost like a free pass when there are so many people who don't commit the crime?
Right. I mean, even the research coming out on psychopaths that seemingly have control and knowledge and consequences and have healthy brains and just don't have well-developed consciences, let's say, lack of remorse, lack of empathy. I mean, I guess everything's based on our brain, right? But but does that allow them to have some type of mitigating circumstances? Not as much as someone who has schizophrenia, let's say.
Have you come across situations or people you've had to evaluate where there's nothing in their childhood or in their life or when you look at their brain that could point to why this would have happened?
I do have cases where it seems that the person is more bad than mad or damaged.
Okay.
You do scratch your head.
Yeah.
And we kind of say, okay, well, they have a personality disorder.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's not in a vacuum. I mean, those are based on risk factors as well. But there are some cases where the person has seemingly good attachment. I am seeing some cases where the kid's spoiled. Okay. And they parents are spoiling them. Everything's done for them. They're coddled. They don't have, you know, responsibilities. They're entitled. And then they do a number of bad things. And, you know, we feel sorry for them. Why? You know, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, the millennial generation is kind of.
That's true. Yeah. The entitlement.
Not all millennials are criminals.
No, you know, that's very true.
Right.
Yeah. That's interesting. I've just got a couple more questions for you, sure. And then I'll let you go. I've taken up a lot of your time. Okay. Do you think there is something we can do to help deter people away from a life of crime?
Well, I mean, as far as, you know, there have been studies on the death penalty and does that deter not the acute offender who in the life circumstance situation is going to think, oh, let me think before I do this. No, but
no, you never think that's going to happen, right? Like you never think if I shoot this person, I'm going to get the death penalty.
No, there's other things going on in that moment. But I will say that, you know, the rehabilitation model, especially like with juveniles, I'm kind of more interested in. People are less molded. I think there's some studies on what we call multisystemic therapy in the U.S., and that has more to do with therapy with the family. It has been shown to have some promise. You're never going to cut out the poverty and I steal because I need something. You know, there's different theories of crime, certainly. So, but I think that the family dynamics are very dysfunctional. So that's one thing really needs, you know, the broken home. One of the major factors of criminality is not living with mother and father to age 16 together. Like, you know, youth is not living with parents. And that's not going to be something you can just do that, you know, but family therapy is a huge part of that. I think as you probably know, the substance abuse issue is, and dual diagnosis is a huge issue with youth.
So. Okay. Well, actually, yeah, we'll end with that question about substance abuse. A lot of research coming out about marijuana in particular. Some people think it helps in certain ways. Other people think it's still no good. Where do you sit on that? Does it affect your brain development? Does it affect your decision making? Is it helpful in some medical cases?
There are some meta and analytic kind of group studies I won't quote right now, but I'll say that there are some neurocognitive brain kind of dysfunction I'd say negative data saying that actually marijuana does affect negatively affect brain development and function. So I'm not supportive of it. I will say even yesterday, my defendant who had significant childhood trauma was saying as an adolescent and adult, he had used marijuana to calm him. And as you know, self-medicate the trauma, the depression, anxiety, PTSD that he had. So I can't, you know, I can't play moral creator or director when I didn't have his childhood. People that have those raised by wolf childhoods are often miserable. And they are more at risk to want to feel good and avoid those horrors based on use of marijuana. Can I get on a soapbox and say they're wrong? No. Can I say, hey, the studies will say that you're more likely to have brain dysfunction? Yeah.
And the same with alcohol, wouldn't it?
A lot of the younger kids really turn to marijuana to, I do see more chronic effects of alcohol than marijuana with older folks.
Okay. That's interesting. All right.
I will end this with saying this. Stay away from methamphetamine. That is the big one.
That's the big one. That's the
that,
one.
That is related to acute connection to homicide.
Okay.
Okay. Paranoia and induced psychosis.
Yeah.
Long-term schizophrenia when off of the drug, leading to what we call settled insanity or settled psychosis. Now you have schizophrenia because you use meth and it's not going away because you stop using the drug. And then brain functional impairments related to memory and attention, especially, that may not get better.
Okay.
They're from chronic
use. Scary, isn't it?
Yeah. So that would be the number one drug that is consistent, that is damaging acute in the short term and in the long term chronically.
Do you think, I know I said I wouldn't ask any more questions, but just quickly on the drugs and that, do you think if you've got someone who is a drug user, a drug abuser, they've had drug problems somewhere, even if it's in their 20s, whatever, and then they go and they get clean, but then years later they go and have a child, are they at a higher risk of that child having some sort of a deformity?
Mom more so, I will say, just because they're using, the child's more likely to use themselves.
Okay.
And now their own brain, and your brain is quite elastic and strong and resilient. So, you know, your brain, depending on the drug, the age you started, the frequency, you know, your brain can bounce back quite significantly. But in this age, it's safe. It's just, it's better not to use.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. It's better not to use.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. For this. You're welcome.
I learned a lot, actually. There's a lot of things I didn't know once you start to dig into it all, but it's fascinating, the brain. And thank you so much for your time. No, I really appreciate it.
And no problem. Glad I could help. Be safe with our virus situation is not good.
Oh, yes.
And good luck with your studies.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out. Class dismissed.